Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and today we've got a really special interview for you. During the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting we covered last month, Liz pre-recorded an interview with Dr. Andy Farkey to coincide with the release of a paper describing a new dinosaur. So if you're listening to this on or close to release date, then you don't really get much more current than this. Don't forget to visit our website to view pictures and reconstructions of this new dinosaur, and I'll join you again after the interview to fill you in on the latest PaleoCast news. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Thanks for joining us, Andy.
Absolutely.
Today, we have Andy Farkey from the Raymond Elf Museum of Paleontology. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in ceratopsians and kind of got where you are now?
Yeah. So my story is one that begins when I was about 4 years old. I'm originally from the state of South Dakota. And when we were on a family vacation, we went out to Rapid City, South Dakota, where they have this cool place called Dinosaur Park, which was an old basically set of concrete dinosaurs on the hill overlooking the city, and that's where I fell in love with dinosaurs, and I've never really grown up since. As a high school student, living in South Dakota, I was really interested in dinosaurs, and I found that there was some really cool research to be done on animals like Triceratops, and so some of my science fair projects early on, I started working with those. I got in touch with a lot of scientists, had a lot of support, through telephone and through mail, because this was back in the days before the internet, and that got me launched into a career studying horned dinosaurs like Triceratops and all of its friends.
Very cool. Can you tell us kind of a little bit about ceratopsians?
Mm-hmm. So a ceratopsian dinosaur is something, when people think of ceratopsians or horned dinosaurs, first thing that comes to mind is something like Triceratops, this big, maybe 20, 25, 30 foot long animal walking around on four legs with a giant, 5 or 6 foot long skull with horns and a big frill sticking out the back. And that's a pretty good description of, most of the later horned dinosaurs, but the group actually includes a whole bunch of other things that looked quite different. Some of the earliest horned dinosaurs or ceratopsians were actually these little guys, maybe 3 or 4 feet long, walked around on just their hind legs. They had a little skull, maybe with a parrot-like beak at the front, but otherwise, the rest of the skull was fairly plain. So we have everything within horned dinosaurs, from these small bipeds to these large four-legged animals with huge heads.
When did that transition from a smaller bipedal animal to a larger quadrupedal one happen? How far along in ceratopsian kind of evolution did that change?
Yeah, so for most of their history, actually, the horned dinosaurs were pretty small, pretty bipedal animals. The oldest fossils we have are from about the late Jurassic of China, and those are very clearly small and bipedal. And it's not until stuff that was living around maybe 80 or 90 million years ago that we have definite quadrupeds, so animals that were, walking around on their 4 feet at all times. And so the thought is, why are they going from being bipedal to quadrupedal? Some of it's probably body size. They're getting big, and, when you have these big heads, it's a lot easier to carry them around if you have four legs to carry them on. And so the head size also, and the development of these big frills and these horns is probably also tied in part to being, permanently quadrupedal.
And where did the first ceratopsians evolve? What part of the world do they come from?
So all the earliest horned dinosaurs that we know of are from Asia, so China in particular, as well as a few fossils from Mongolia. And these are showing, very small, fairly standard plant-eating dinosaur-looking things.
Talking about the horns and frills, as you mentioned, as they get bigger, they have a lot of this ornamentation. Is there evidence of what that ornamentation was for? I know you often see in popular culture the T-Rex fighting the Triceratops and fending it off with its horn. Is there any actual evidence of that? Mm-hmm.
Or? Yeah, so the use for these horns and these frills has been something that's been fairly controversial amongst paleontologists. Just trying to figure out what they're doing with them, as well as, you know, like, can we even know what they were doing with them? You know, obviously, if you have a living animal, like a living antelope or sheep, you can go out in the wild or to a farm and see what they're doing, which is often, you know, fighting with each other or using them for visual display or any other number of things. And we just don't have that convenience with horned dinosaurs. So what we're aiming for instead in this case is basically we have to go to the fossils and figure this out. So one thing we can do is kind of, you know, analogize. So say, you know, these animals had horns, modern animals with horns do this, and so they must have been doing the same thing back in the Cretaceous. And, you know, that gets you part of the way. It's a good way to, you know, start getting ideas, but it's not really a test of what they're actually doing. So one of the things that I've worked on in the course of my career has been looking at paleopathology, which is the study of injuries and disease within the fossil record. One study in particular that I did was co-authored with scientists Darren Tanke and Ewan Wolf. So what we did is we basically looked at a whole bunch of different skulls for Triceratops, the classic three-horned dinosaur, as well as its cousin Centrosaurus, which was this animal from Alberta that had a big nose horn on its over its nose, you know, kind of short stubby brow horns, and then sort of a short, relatively ornamented frill. And we wanted to see, like, do Triceratops and Centrosaurus have the same patterns of purported injuries on their skulls, because the idea is, well, if they're using their skulls in the same way, they should have very similar patterns of injury, and if they're using their skulls in different ways, they should have very different patterns of injury. And this is sort of, you know, probably the best modern analogy would be if you think about a football player versus a tennis player. They're going to have, you know, they're doing very different things with their body, so they're going to have very, very different kinds of injuries that pop up. And so we assume we can do this with animals. So what we found when we looked at our Triceratops and our Centrosaurus is that, you know, yes, you do get different patterns of, you know, what look like injuries on the skull, and so that suggests to us that they were probably, you know, using their skulls for some sort of horn locking behavior, so they were fighting with each other, and because they have different patterns there, it would suggest that they're using their horns and their skulls in slightly different ways. So I'd caution that, you know, we can't look at a particular skull that has something we think is an injury and, you know, say that, oh, you know, this is how it happened. It was in a fight with another animal. You can't usually do that with individual skulls, but if you look at the overall pattern, you know, the overall spectrum of, you know, weird things on skulls, then that's, you know, that's what the data seem to show.
What about the frills of ceratopsians? You often get this kind of crazy ornamentation. Mm-hmm. If you look at Styracosaurus versus Centrosaurus, it varies quite a bit. And I mm-hmm. can't really see a functional thing for that, mm-hmm. but is that something that's maybe sexually dimorphic or some kind of sexual selection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the evolution of the frill in horned dinosaurs is a pretty fascinating topic. The thing I find quite interesting is that the early ones have relatively short frills, but those frills are loaded up with jaw muscles. So what I would suspect is that, at least at the beginning, the frill is, you know, maybe in part used for show, you know, display, but there's a big component of, you know, using it for feeding, you know, so if you want to chew on, you know, really tough things, that, you know, you need that big frill to support the big jaw muscles. And I think it was later, you know, kind of co-opted for display. You know, obviously, if you have a big, flashy structure, they're probably going to use it to show off to other animals. You know, and then, you know, from there, like, you know, which is the most important thing, you know, associated with the evolution of that, you know, whether it's for, you know, sexual selection within a particular species or telling one species from the next, that's a little harder to tell, just because, you know, we don't have a big enough sample for many. One big question that's come up frequently is the idea of sexual dimorphism in dinosaurs, so where you have males that look different from the females, either in size or in shape or some feature that you see on the skull. And it's been proposed before with the early horned dinosaur Protoceratops, but that doesn't seem to really hold up when you really look at the data with any detail. And in other cases, we just don't have enough specimens. You know, you need a lot of specimens to be able to, determine which might be male, which might be female, and then to separate out, the variation in the frill from variation that, might be due to the sex of the animal versus variation due to the age of the animal versus evolutionary differences. You know, if you're not looking at stuff from the exact same time, you could be seeing evolutionary changes rather than, differences between males and females. Or if you're not looking at specimens that are all the same age, you might be just looking at a young animal versus an old animal. So it's really complicated, and even in the best cases, animals like Centrosaurus or Protoceratops, where you have in some cases dozens of specimens, even that isn't enough to be able to, really see if there's any variation. We just don't know. Which is, on the one hand it's frustrating, but on the other hand it means there's some, real great possibilities for research down the line.
What about things like bone beds? Because I know there's several large bone beds of animals like Pachyrhinosaurus and Centrosaurus. Mm-hmm. So do those give you any more indications if you have so many individuals in one place?
Yeah, so these bone beds where you have, a number of specimens of, say, Centrosaurus, they're... main thing that they show is that there's a lot of variation in the frill. What we don't see is that there's animals that absolutely lack horns or absolutely lack, ornamentation on the frill versus animals that have it, which that'd be fairly obviously, male and female, which one that would be is, up to, it would be an open question. But we just don't see that kind of really, really major differences. And so that's a problem. The differences that are going on are probably fairly subtle. I mean, I suspect that if we were to get a big enough sample, we would see differences between males and females, but we just don't have, even with a bone bed that has, dozens of animals, it's still not enough to be able to test it, unfortunately. It's very frustrating, really, for I think the level of variation that we have, between males and females, you need a much bigger sample than what anyone has at the moment.
How does the frill and the ornamentation change throughout ontogeny, throughout a horned dinosaur's life? What kind of changes might you expect to see?
Yeah, so there are some really well-documented changes in the skull. And this actually is something that, although it's been it's received a lot of attention recently, it's actually a line of research that goes back decades. When they were first finding Protoceratops skulls in Mongolia back in the 1920s, and as they were studied through the 1930s, scientists recognized that not every skull looked the same. And in fact, small skulls, which were presumably young animals, were very different from the large skulls, the older animals. And up to that point, often it was very common for, these animals, small and large skulls that look different to be interpreted as different species, particularly for dinosaurs. But I think the researchers at that time, who were Barnum Brown and Eric Schleicher, were really forward-thinking in that they recognized that, all these differences are just, basically how these animals change as they grow up. And so they were able to put together a growth series for Protoceratops. And what they found is that the young Protoceratops, they have of course they're quite tiny. They don't have any horns of any sort on their face, and their frill is fairly short and, not that big. But then as the animals get older, of course the skull gets bigger, but along with that they start to grow sort of proto-horns on the nose. You get just this little bump on the snout that gets quite big as the animals get older. And then the frill, that bony piece of stuff sticking off the back of the skull, that got much broader, much longer, and much bigger overall. So they're adding on these kind of nose bump and this frill. And so that's basically where Protoceratops ended up. They didn't elaborate the skull much beyond that. And then when we look to other animals, so the later true horned dinosaurs, such as Centrosaurus and Triceratops, what we find is that these animals start off with tiny horns and tiny frills. But as they grow, they start to really elaborate on these things. So the horns get bigger in Triceratops. They change from pointing backwards to pointing forwards. And then on the frill expands. And then the little, there's little nubs of bone on the edge that sort of change shape. And that's, Triceratops basically, there's some changes, big changes in the proportions of the frill and the horns. And then in animals like Centrosaurus or Styracosaurus, they actually start off with a frill that's got, just little nubs of bone, very similar to what you'd see in Triceratops. But as those animals get bigger, those little nubs of bone on the edge of the frill become these huge spikes and hooks and all sorts of, really crazy things. So they're adding on all this stuff as they get older. So they start off with fairly simple skulls that might have like the basic horns and frill, and then they're elaborating upon it as they get older.
in the large bone beds, you often get all of these different ages and all of these morphologies. So what does that tell us about the biology and kind of living of these animals? What do these bone beds teach us?
Yeah, so probably the biggest thing, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, how do you interpret these kinds of bone beds? Because, you know, I think the temptation when you find a bunch of things together is that, oh, they were living in a herd, you know, they had a complex social structure. And that's all quite possible. But really, you know, at the most basic level, you know, you can just say, well, all these animals died together. Then you have to start looking a little more carefully to figure out why they died together in the first place. Was it because they were in, you know, a herd that had a complex social structure, you know, with like a leader of the herd and, you know, all of its followers? Or, you know, was it a situation maybe where you had a bunch of animals that normally didn't live together that were maybe gathered in one spot because there was water in that area or there was a good food resource? And, you know, maybe they, you know, they didn't think about much about, you know, the next animal there. Or was it something, you know, something in between? It's, I think, fairly critical to keep in mind that a lot of modern animals today that we don't think of as having like really complex social structures live together. Turtles are a great example. Like if you go to a pond on a warm summer day, you'll see a whole bunch of turtles all in one place. And if they were to get fossilized at once, you know, would you assume that it was a herd with a, you know,
turtle
like a turtle herd, you know, or is it more of, you know, maybe a turtle infestation? So it just happened to be, you know, a lot of resources for those turtles. And so that's been something that's kind of tough to parse out. Personally, I think, you know, that it probably was different for different horned dinosaurs. We have, you know, these bone beds or these associations for a number of different horned dinosaurs, but some of them, for instance, some of the animals from the Two Medicine Formation, we have some where it's only juveniles together, no adults. This animal, it was called Brachyceratops, but probably is a juvenile of something similar to animals called Ineosaurus or Kelosaurus. So we just have juveniles in that, so no adults there. You know, maybe some of these animals, some of these species were just living together in groups for one particular life stage. Maybe there were just certain times of year when they were living together. You know, we don't know in some cases, but I think, you know, looking at the fact that these animals have, you know, pretty clear display structures, the fact that we find some of them in bone beds together, you know, there's probably something going on. How complex that was, you know, whether it was like a modern antelope level of complexity, or, you know, even a, you know, kind of the surprising complexity that we see in modern crocodiles and alligators that are living together, you know, it's hard to tell.
Do any different species of horned dinosaurs overlap in time and place? Do you find at any point that something like a Centrosaurus was living at the same time in the same area as another kind of ceratopsian? Does that...
Yeah, so it depends a lot on, you know, kind of the part of the world you're looking at. For instance, if you look at the Hell Creek Formation, which is, you know, the last, you know, probably around 68 to 66 million years ago, so the very tail end of the age of dinosaurs, Triceratops is ridiculously common. And there's probably one other species around at that time, this animal called Torosaurus, which controversially has been suggested to be the, you know, just another growth form of Triceratops, although I don't think most scientists accept that. But at the very least, you know, regardless of that, you know, there's pretty much just one horned dinosaur and maybe something else that's really, really, really rare. But if you go back in time a little further, say to maybe around 75 or 76 million years ago, in places like Alberta or places like Utah, you have sometimes two or maybe even three or four species of horned dinosaurs living alongside each other. They're not generally very closely related to each other. For instance, in Alberta, you might have Centrosaurus living alongside this animal called Chasmosaurus. And you know, that's pretty much what you have. Down south in Utah, you might have animals like Utah Ceratops and Cosmoceratops and Nasutoceratops living alongside each other, so three species, none of which are terribly closely related to each other. But the neat thing is when you start to look at the fossil record, particularly in places like Alberta, you actually see replacement of species over time. So it's a dinosaur park in Alberta's, you know, really great example of that, where you find you know, Centrosaurus in basically one layer of rocks, and if you go a little bit higher, you find Styracosaurus, and there's, you know, very little, if any, overlap between those two species.
Is that something that might be showing an evolutionary transition, or is that something that's just what you found? But could it be that Styracosaurus has evolved from something like Centrosaurus, or?
So, I suspect that Styracosaurus probably evolved from something like Centrosaurus, but there's it's hard to tell because it takes a lot of specimens and a lot of work, and the dinosaur park and the surrounding areas in Alberta are really just one little snapshot. So there's some ongoing work by folks like Caleb Brown that have been investigating, trying to tease that apart. So I think in the next year or two, we're going to hear some really exciting and informative information on what was actually going on with the evolution of animals like that.
I wish I had seen his talk yesterday then. Thinking about kind of more modern methods, I do a lot of work with CT scanning, and I can imagine that trying to CT scan something like a Styracosaurus or a Triceratops skull would be quite difficult.
Yep.
Have you been able to apply any of these newer methods to ceratopsians?
Yeah, so when I was doing my dissertation research, I was able to CT scan some of these skulls, but what I had to do is find basically big skulls that had been broken into smaller pieces, which is not ideal, but you gotta go with what you can get actually through the CT scanner. So I did work with some partial skulls that allowed me to look at details of brain anatomy and details of some of the other spaces in the skull. So I've used some of that. I in some very recent projects have been using surface scanning, so basically laser surface scanning, or using photos through a technique called photogrammetry, which actually will let you digitize big specimens. So I've been using that to digitize some of these, which you can then use once you have the model, you can use it to investigate various research questions.
That's definitely interesting. I was just picturing trying to put a Styracosaurus skull somewhere into a CT scanner and not able to figure that out.
It's not going to happen in most cases. There are very big CT scanners available, ones that are used, there's one at UT Austin that will do things almost ceratopsian sized.
Okay.
And then there's some that are, that are used in the industry for looking at, say, jet engines or car engine blocks or whatever. But, those are very expensive, and plus you got to get a large, fragile skull from point A to point B.
Yes.
So it's technically right now, it's difficult, if not effectively impossible, but and maybe in 20 years or something, there'll be some cool piece of technology that'll come out and let us do these big skulls and look at their internal anatomy.
Hopefully, that would definitely be great to be able to see it internally. Speaking of kind of new finds and interesting things, you have a really interesting new little ceratopsian that you've described. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this animal that we just recently published is this animal called Aquilops. It's a horned dinosaur, but it's not a dinosaur that has horns, which means it's an early member of the ceratopsians. So this is an animal that lived in what's now southern Montana about, say, 105, 106 million years ago. And it's cool on several levels. First of which is, this is the first time we've ever had a good specimen of a horned dinosaur from this time period within North America. In the past, we weren't even sure if these kinds of dinosaurs lived in North America. At that time, there's a great fossil record from Asia from the early Cretaceous, but all that had been found in North America were just these teeth that, eventually people settled on, saying that they are horned dinosaurs, they are ceratopsian teeth, but we don't know what they, what kind they are exactly. Is it something related to this animal or that animal? And so now with this skull, we're able to really, figure out what's going on in North America at that time. The specimen was found in what's called the Cloverleaf Formation. So people mainly, when they think of the animals from there, they think of animals like Deinonychus or Tenontosaurus. So this new animal, Aquilops, is something that was living alongside those, but it was very, very rare. All we have from all the research that's been done in the Cloverleaf Formation, in the past several decades, is just this one skull. Not even isolated teeth are known. So this is it.
What kind of size for the animal are we looking at for this?
Yeah, so this is the animal that's probably about the size of a crow. So it's about in terms of body length and body mass, the skull itself fits very nicely in the palm of your hand. So if you think about later animals like Triceratops, 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot long skulls, and here we have this little horned dinosaur, it's pocket sized. Or at least its skull is pocket sized. So this is a little animal. And that means, you know, it's very different from what we, you know, some of the later animals that we would see. Though it's big, it's probably bipedal also, or sorry, it's small, but it's also probably bipedal, based on what its relatives looked like.
Wow, that's definitely not what I expect to be related to something like a Triceratops.
No, me either.
So just kind of wrap up, where do you think the future of Ceratopsian research is going? What do you think is the next kind of big step in horned dinosaurs?
Well, as with everything, I think there's a big need to find new fossils of, you know, parts of the Ceratopsian family tree that aren't well known. You know, for instance, the Aquilops is great because it fills in this gap in our knowledge of North American horned dinosaurs early in their evolution, and it also shows how they relate to animals that lived elsewhere in the world at the time. But there's other parts, you know, for instance, the origin of the true Ceratopsians, the true Ceratopsids, the ancestors of, you know, the common ancestor of animals like Centrosaurus and Triceratops. You know, we don't have a good idea of what their immediate ancestor would have looked like. We have things, you know, that are sort of close to it, but, you know, we don't know, like, you know, what was the ancestral Triceratops and Centrosaurus. So I think that's an important thing to find, and other parts of the family tree that we don't know yet. I think there's also a lot of room for continued work on understanding how these animals used their frills and their horns. You know, I'd love to know, like, you know, with a huge sample, you know, maybe ideally probably even hundreds of specimens, not just dozens of specimens, but hundreds of specimens, showing, you know, were there differences between male and female? You know, we need more information on how different horned dinosaurs grew. You know, how did they change? And, you know, what were they doing with these horns and these frills? So I think that's the other big areas, you know, the function, you know, what are these things being used for, as well as the overall evolution of the group.
That's great. I look forward to hearing more about it in the future and seeing where you go with that. And hopefully we'll hear more about Ceratopsian function, because I think that looking at the skulls is really interesting. I think that's something I'd really like to learn more about. So that's great. Thanks for joining us today, Andy.
Thank you. There's a lot of work to do yet. So hopefully someone out there listening will will get on it.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, a new dinosaur for you, which I think makes for quite a good episode. In fact, if you're an academic and have a paper in publication, then we'd love to hear from you too. It's a great way to be able to share the latest research with our audience, and it increases your exposure via our podcast or social media outlets. Everyone wins. So Aquilops, such a great name for a dinosaur, and it's pretty cute as well. I love the reconstruction on our website of it being held by a human for scale. It makes me wonder if they'd make good pets or not. What do you think? Let us know in the comments section. The next you're going to hear from us will be our live streaming of the Paleontological Association Annual General Meeting in Leeds on the 17th and 18th of December, starting at around 9 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time every day. We're going to be broadcasting many great talks of all the latest paleontological research from across the whole field. And our next podcast will be our final one we pre-recorded at SVP with a true legend of dinosaur research. So we look forward to seeing you again soon.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.